content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading from the January 19th, 2018 issue of the Week magazine. I am looking at the cover drawing, and there is a lot going on in this one. It is looks like a child's bedroom, and there is a miniature body-wise Donald Trump in kind of a onesie, a toddler onesie outfit that looks like it's got a tie to it and a normal size head. He's in a playpen and he's screaming and he's throwing out this fake phone or a toy phone that's got the Twitter bird on the front of it. There's toys strewn all over the place, broken crayons. It's actually kind of a funny one. In the background, like a parent that doesn't know what to do in the doorway, Mr. Trump's chief of staff, John Kelly, is standing there with his arms crossed. So the title says, Is Trump Unfit? A new book's explosive claim that the president is mentally unstable. And with that, we will go to the main stories and how they were covered. Starting with Trump's rage over a scathing new book, What Happened? President Trump this week pushed back hard against a new book that portrays him as volatile, semi-literate, and mentally unstable, dismissing the account as fiction, threatening the publisher with legal action, and slamming former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon as a leaker who lost his mind when he lost his job. Written by journalist Michael Wolff, Fire and Fury portrays a dysfunctional White House filled with warring factions, with Trump's despairing staff openly questioning his fitness for the presidency. After an excerpt was published last week, Trump's lawyers issued publisher Henry Holt a cease and desist letter threatening to sue for libel and demanding that publication be halted, dismissing the request as flagrantly unconstitutional. Henry Holt published the book 4 days early. Trump dismissed concerns over his mental health, tweeting that he was, like, really smart and a very stable genius, and promised to take a strong look at libel laws, saying it was a disgrace such a book could be published. Fire and Fury's release precipitated a dramatic fall from grace for Bannon. He was quoted in the book describing a 2016 Trump Tower meeting involving Donald Trump Jr. and Kremlin-linked officials as treasonous, mocking Ivanka Trump as dumb as a brick, and warning that special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation would be like a Category 5 hurricane for the White House. Bannon claimed he had been misunderstood and asserted his unwavering support for the president. But White House officials said there was no way back for the former strategist, whom Trump derisively labeled Sloppy Steve. The billionaire Mercer family publicly cut ties with the former Goldman Sachs executive, and this week he was ousted as executive chairman of Breitbart News, the race-baiting website that enabled his political rise. What the editorial said: the media has portrayed Trump's risible effort to stop Fire and Fury being published as a DEFCON 1 level threat to the survival of the republic, said the Wall Street Journal. It's nothing of the sort. Legal threats are a long-standing Trump tactic to intimidate journalists who say things he doesn't like. But courts only block books from being published if they violate national security, and lawyers could never prove that Wolf intentionally lied about the president, the legal standard for libeling a public figure. Hillary Clinton, who wanted to rewrite the First Amendment to undo the Citizens United Supreme Court ruling on campaign contributions, posed a far more dangerous threat to free speech than Trump does. Trump's legal threats against the book badly backfired, said the Boston Herald. He gave Fire and Fury millions of dollars worth of free publicity. It topped bestseller lists in the U.S., the U.K., and Canada, and kept discussion of his mental stability at the top of the news agenda. You'd think Trump had negotiated a share of the profits. What the columnist said. Good riddance, Mr. Bannon, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. A flagrant self-promoter who built his brand on being the ultimate Trumpist, the Breitbart firebrand never had the political know-how or popular support to realize his nationalist vision. Having now been kicked to the curb by the very man whose values he claimed to represent, Bannon is like a parish priest who has been roundly denounced by the Pope. Bannon is finished. Nonetheless, Bannon told the truth about Trump, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. The president is unbalanced, a man-child driven by primitive needs and impulses, and guilty of a wide array of misdeeds. But that's a truth Republicans are completely unwilling to acknowledge. So Bannon's swift excommunication removes the last vestige of conflict between party and president. Trump has joined the Republican establishment, which in turn now embraces and defends him. Bannon's biggest betrayal was acknowledging that the Mueller investigation is no hoax, said Timothy O'Brien in Bloomberg.com. He correctly warned that Mueller will follow the trail of Trump's Russia ties to money laundering, possibly involving Donald Jr., Jared Kushner, and the president himself. Trump has long-standing real estate and licensing deals with questionable business associates, including some from Russia. Trump knows how vulnerable he and his family are on this front, and Bannon does too. That's why the president wants to shut him up and shut him down. Our controversy of the week, Hillary Clinton, why she's under investigation again. President Trump has nursed a curious and seemingly indefatigable obsession with Hillary Clinton throughout his presidency, said Abigail Tracy in VanityFair.com. Trump recently tweeted that the Justice Department ought to look into how Clinton got away with deleting 33,000 emails. No justice. And last week he added that Clinton aide Huma Abedin should be prosecuted for having stored classified emails on her husband's laptop. Trump's Clinton obsession has now taken a darker turn. The Department of Justice, it was revealed last week, has indeed reopened an investigation of Clinton's email practices. At the same time, the FBI is reportedly reviving a dormant investigation into the Clinton Family Foundation to determine if foundation donors received special favors from Clinton's State Department. Trump may not have directly ordered reopening these probes, but the timing lends credence to growing fears that Trump is pushing to weaponize government institutions against his enemies. At the very least, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com, the investigations are designed to protect Trump from the Russia investigation and feed the right-wing news media's message that Trump's opponents are the real criminals. At worst, our vindictive president is trying to turn the U.S. into a Russia-like autocracy, where his political opponents really are locked up. Trump's bombastic taunts contribute to that impression, said Ed Rogers in the Washington Post. But a fresh look at the Clinton scandals is entirely justified. We've only just learned, for instance, about the anti-Trump bias of investigator Peter Strzok, who changed the words grossly negligent to extremely careless in the FBI's statement to Congress about Clinton's email server, downgrading a possible criminal charge to a wrist slap, to ignore her egregious destruction of emails and the vast sums raised by the Clinton Foundation from foreign donors would suggest a systemic favoritism that is contrary to the American system. Clinton's mishandling of classified information was clearly criminal, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com, and was probably driven by a need to cover up her entanglement of State Department and Clinton Foundation business. If we care about restoring the rule of law, then truly unbiased investigations are long overdue. Well, that all sounds very familiar, said David Ferris in TheWeek.com. From the monumental years-long travesty of endless Benghazi investigations, all the way back to the vile speculation about the Clintons' involvement in the death of Vince Foster, the Republican Party has been pursuing baseless, ginned-up rabbit hunts of Clinton world for decades. Even with Bill and Hillary both now out of office and retired, the GOP is desperately hoping that a few more Clinton pseudo-investigations will distract the public from Trump's very grave legal jeopardy and help the GOP avoid coughing up one or both chambers of Congress in November. Many reasonable people think Clinton deserved to be prosecuted in the email affair, said the Weekly Standard in an editorial. But she already was investigated and cleared of any crime. For the Justice Department to reopen a closed case now, after public pressure from the president, really does seem like the kind of political payback we associate with dictatorships and banana republics. Unless fresh evidence has emerged to justify renewed investigations, said Andrew Prokop in Vox.com, Americans should be deeply troubled. If one day we wake up in a nation where the Justice Department routinely serves to prosecute the president's political enemies, we may look back at this week as where it began. And it's time for our good week, bad week feature. It was a good week for indivisibility with a computer's discovery of the largest so far known prime number. Space does not permit a printing of the number here, but it has 23,249,425 digits and is one less than 2 to the 77,232,917th power. That's big. It was a good week for Randall Hansen, author of Fire and Fury, The Allied Bombing of Germany, 1942 to 1945, which unexpectedly landed on bestseller lists amid overwhelming demand for Michael Wolff's similarly titled White House expose. I haven't seen this level of interest since the book first came out, marveled Hansen. And it was a good week for talking to your toilet. After developers at CES 2018, the Consumer Electronics Expo, unveiled an internet-connected toilet that can be commanded to play music and respond to voice commands such as lift the seat and flush. But it was a bad week for Miami's Museum of Ice Cream, which was fined for polluting the environment with plastic fake sprinkles tracked out into the city by departing customers. The museum said it was consulting with environmental experts to develop a biodegradable sprinkle. It was a bad week for the swift completion of their appointed rounds after a gang of aggressive wild turkeys kept mail carriers from reaching up to 30 Ohio homes for the past 3 weeks. Carriers are arming themselves with air horns and will try to make deliveries at night. And it was a bad week for Oregonians, many of whom are not happy about a new law that allows motorists to pump their own gas for the first time in state history. "I refuse to pump my own gas," one resident wrote in an online poll. "I had to do it once while visiting my brother in California, and I almost died." And before we move on from here, we'll take a short, boring, but important note. Regulators nix coal and nuclear bailout. Federal regulators this week rejected a proposal by Energy Secretary Rick Perry to subsidize struggling nuclear and coal-fired power plants. Dozens of such plants have closed in recent years, unable to compete with cheap natural gas and renewable energy sources. Perry's plan would have provided financial reward to plants that can store a 90-day fuel supply on site, a criteria only met by coal and nuclear plants. Subsidizing these plants to stockpile fuel, Perry argued, would make the grid more reliable and prevent outages. But the five-member Federal Energy Regulatory Commission unanimously rejected the proposal, saying there was no evidence for Perry's claims. Four of the panel's members were nominated by President Trump. On the briefing page, we have our growing national debt. The U.S. debt is $20.5 trillion and rising. Should Americans be worried? Why does the U.S. owe so much? Apart from a four-year stretch during the economic boom of the late 1990s, the federal government has run a budget deficit every year since 1970. In 2017, the shortfall was $666 billion. The national debt is now slightly larger than the size of the entire U.S. economy, equal to 106% of the country's gross domestic product. Overall, the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, expects the national debt to surpass $30 trillion by 2028, as Medicare and Social Security costs soar to cover aging baby boomers. Outgoing Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen has warned that the country's growing debt load could eventually become unsustainable. "It's the type of thing that should keep people awake at night," she told Congress in November. Why is it a problem? Like any credit card user, the government must pay interest on its debt. For much of the past decade, that hasn't been a major problem because of historically low interest rates. Net interest payments on the debt represented 6.8% of the federal budget in 2017, or $276.2 billion, compared with more than 15% in the mid-1990s. But with the Fed unwinding its post-recession stimulus campaign, interest rates are expected to rise steadily in the coming years. As a result, the CBO estimates, the cost of servicing the national debt is expected to nearly triple by 2027, leaving the government paying more on interest payments than on national defense. Is everyone worried? No. Economists point out that the debt can be used to fund important investments, such as stimulating the economy during a recession or fighting unavoidable wars. The nation's debt is also wildly different from a household's budget, because the government can print its own money and has a theoretically infinite lifespan to pay off its obligations. Some theorists even argue that deficits and the debt are mostly irrelevant. One emerging school of thought, known as modern monetary theory, argues that inflation is the only obstacle standing in the way of the government creating and spending as much money as it wants. The national debt is not a national crisis, says economist Stephanie Kelton, a former advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders. The fact that 21% of all children in the United States live in poverty, that's a crisis. Who owns the debt? About three quarters is held by investors in the form of treasury securities sold by the government to raise money. The rest is intragovernmental debt that comes from Washington borrowing against government trust funds, such as Social Security and Medicare. Americans own most of the public debt, which means that they benefit from the interest paid on it. That includes corporations, state and local governments, and individual investors, many of whom hold treasury bonds in their retirement funds. Foreign investors own about 30% of the nation's total debt, or about $6.3 trillion. America's biggest foreign creditor is China, which holds about 5% of the total debt, followed closely by Japan. This could become a problem if the U.S. ever damaged its credit rating. But for now, American debt is still considered one of the world's safest assets. Has the U.S. always been in debt? President Andrew Jackson briefly paid off the national debt in 1835, partly with proceeds from lands seized from Native American tribes. Otherwise, the U.S. has been in hock for nearly every year of its existence, beginning with the bill for the Revolutionary War. The debt peaked after World War II, ballooning to 119% the size of the GDP in 1946. But it swiftly shrank during the post-war economic boom. The debt load bottomed out at about 24% of GDP in 1974 and has been rising ever since. But it was after the Great Recession in 2007 that the debt really began to explode. Tax revenues cratered while the government spent heavily trying to stave off economic collapse, including George W. Bush's $700 billion bank bailout, known as TARP, and Barack Obama's $787 billion economic stimulus package. What can be done to pay it off? Theoretically, paying down the debt is simply a matter of spending less and collecting more in taxes. But voters don't like spending cuts or tax increases, so politicians who want to be reelected avoid them. Depending on whether they're in power or out, both Democrats and Republicans are conveniently inconsistent in their views on debt. During the 2008 presidential campaign, Obama chided Bush for unpatriotic deficit spending on the Iraq War and tax cuts, which helped increase the total debt by 101% during the Bush years. But Obama increased the debt by 68% during his own presidency, arguing that deficit spending was necessary to rescue the economy. Likewise, Republicans who warned that Obama spending was spending away the country's future have now embraced deficits, arguing that their $1.5 trillion tax plan will pay for itself by generating economic growth, a contention that most economists say is unrealistic. U.S. Representative Mark Walker, Republican from North Carolina, says his party sees the dangers of debt as a great talking point when you have an administration that's Democrat-led. It's a little different now that Republicans have both houses and the administration. And it's time for a few columns. We'll take two this week from the U.S. The first is titled, Giving Kim Jong-un a Bloody Nose. It's somewhat reassuring that North and South Korea are now attempting to lower tensions through diplomacy, said Gerald Seeb. But Kim Jong-un won't end his nuclear program, and war remains a real possibility. U.S. officials are now debating a bloody nose strategy in which we react to Kim's next missile or nuclear test with a limited airstrike on North Korean military sites to illustrate the high price the regime could pay for its behavior. It would be a huge gamble. Kim might respond by unleashing an artillery and rocket barrage on Seoul, killing tens of thousands of people in minutes. He might even launch a nuclear missile at the U.S. or one of our allies. While Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and Defense Secretary Jim Mattis are advising that diplomatic efforts continue, National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster is arguing that a bloody nose is just what Kim needs. The wild card is President Trump himself. No one can predict what he'll do or what Kim might do in response. The current talks between the two Koreas may temporarily de-escalate the rhetoric, but if Kim continues to race ahead with his nuclear development, mid-2018 could be a time of reckoning. Conservatives shouldn't ignore cities. Conservatives look at the electoral map and see a vast sea of Republican red and a few blue islands, said Kevin Williamson. Who needs California, they ask, often with a sneer. Who needs New York and New Jersey? The answer? America does. Conservatives, too. Though the Blue Islands are geographically small, they are filled with people, tens of millions of them. One in four U.S. citizens, in fact, live in just four states, California, New York, Illinois, and New Jersey. Yet conservatives blithely dismiss these places as outside real America. Much of what made America great in the first place has come out of coastal urban America. Ellis Island, Wall Street, the movie and TV industries, Silicon Valley, and yes, great Republican leaders. The modern conservative movement itself emerged in Southern California and New York City, with Ronald Reagan and William F. Buckley Jr. leading the way. Today, even in deep red states like Texas, more and more people live in cities like Houston and San Antonio. Writing off half the country is not only bad for the Republican soul, it will also prove bad for Republican electoral prospects in time. This is from the United Kingdom, an ailing health service. Britain's National Health Service is in chaos, said Dennis Campbell and Sarah Marsh in The Guardian. A surge in flu patients, colder weather, and high levels of respiratory illness have slammed hospitals across the country. Beds are full, patients are waiting on trolleys and hallways, and ambulances can't respond quickly to emergency calls. We are seeing conditions that people have not experienced in their working lives, said Dr. Taj Hassan, head of the Royal College of Emergency Medicine, which represents ER doctors. The pressure has led the NHS in England to take the unprecedented step of postponing up to 55,000 non-urgent surgical procedures. Prime Minister Theresa May apologized, saying, "I know it is frustrating." This mess is the result of 7 years of austerity by the ruling Conservative Party, said Dr. Ravi Jayaram in independent.co.uk. The NHS has been consistently underfunded in a way that seems purposeful, as if the government wants a crisis so it can declare socialized medicine a failure and speed up the privatization of services. Just last fall, the boss of NHS England asked for an extra $5.5 billion for the coming winter crush, but the government gave only about a third of that. Primary care services have been decimated, so people go to the ER instead of their own doctor. And with Brexit approaching, we're losing many doctors and nurses from European Union countries who no longer feel welcome in the UK. Britons are willing to spend more on their beloved NHS, said The Observer in an editorial. In much of the world, including the U.S., the poor get substandard care or simply die of treatable conditions. Not here. Our single-payer system is not only free to all, it is also excellent. The Commonwealth Fund, a U.S. think tank, ranks the NHS as the safest, most effective, most affordable health care system in the world, better than those of America, Sweden, and Germany. Yet the UK spends only about 10% of its gross domestic product on health care, while the US spends a hefty 16%. Polls show that two-thirds of Britons favor a tax hike to shore up the NHS. There are no excuses left for the government's failure to act. Money alone won't solve the problem, said the Mail on Sunday. The NHS is antiquated. It was designed for a population of manual workers who died young. Now, though, it must treat millions of well-housed, sedentary workers who eat too much and exercise too little, and still live into their 80s. The whole system needs a redesign, said Camilla Cavendish in The Times. The NHS is not the monolith of popular imagination, but an unwieldy network of 700 organizations, including hospitals, mental health trusts, and regulators, which all charge one another fees and require massive amounts of paperwork. We need one truly unified national medical system. What we have now is a ramshack lifeboat held together with dotted lines and goodwill. It's time for The Last Word, our in-depth feature article, titled this week, When Love Blooms from Grief. Two memoirists with terminal illnesses wrote best-selling books about their final days, said journalist Nora Krug. The spouses they left behind began emailing to offer support and advice and felt a powerful connection. The literary pairing was inevitable. When Breath Becomes Air, Paul Kalanithi's memoir of his final years as he faced lung cancer at age 37, was published posthumously in 2016 to critical acclaim and commercial success. The Bright Hour, Nina Rigg's memoir of her final years as she faced breast cancer at age 39, was published posthumously in 2017 to critical acclaim and commercial success. The two books were mentioned together in numerous reviews, lists, and conversations. Perhaps less inevitable was that the late author's spouses would end up together too. I'm still surprised, said Lucy Kalanithi of her relationship with Nina Rigg's widower, John Duberstein. I'm surprised by how ridiculous it is and how natural it is at the same time. Sitting across the kitchen table from Lucy last week at her home, John agreed. Everything seemed almost bizarrely to fit, he said. It was kind of stunning. The story of Lucy Kalanithi and John Duberstein is both unlikely and destined. The stuff of rom-com, it begins tragically on a deathbed. In the final days of her life, Nina Riggs was worried about her husband and how he would get on with his life when she was gone. Nina made an offhand suggestion. Contact Lucy Kalanithi. She has experience with this, she told him. She'll know what to do. At the time, John had only a vague idea who Lucy was. He had yet to finish reading When Breath Becomes Air. Lucy and Nina, however, had formed a quiet relationship. Lucy, whose husband died in March 2015, had contacted Nina after reading a modern love column she had written for the New York Times. When a Couch is More Than a Couch. Lucy wrote a glowing blurb for The Bright Hour and stayed in touch with Nina's agent, inquiring about Nina's health and her family. On February 24th, 2 days before Nina died, Lucy sent her an email message. "I'm beaming you love from my whole being," she signed it. "Your forever fan, Lucy." At a hospice in Greensboro, North Carolina, John read the email to his ailing wife and responded on her behalf. "Thank you for being such a strong supporter and friend to her," he said. "She's talked about you a ton these past few weeks and her sense of you being a person with a great insight and empathy. She's clearly on the mark there." One of Nina's final acts, in effect, was to play matchmaker for her husband. John, a 41-year-old lawyer, was unmoored by his wife's death. "Bereft, sleep-deprived, fearful of his future, I had so many questions," he said. "I was bursting with this intense need to get things squared." So he did as his wife suggested. He wrote to Lucy 2 days after Nina died, was lengthy and, in Lucy's words, obscenely vulnerable. His requests for advice were wide-ranging. "How do I write a eulogy? How do I sleep through the night? How do I not go insane?" Lucy wrote back immediately, advising John to focus on the eulogy and to take a chill pill about the rest. "I felt a desire to support their family," she says. And Nina was John's character reference. John got through the eulogy. He got through the next day, but not without emailing Lucy. Over the next few weeks and months, she became his lifeline, and in turn, he helped her realize that she had come a long way in the 2 years since her husband's death. "I felt like your guardian," she said. "You totally were," he said. The emails grew in volume and intensity. We learned that when a Gmail thread reaches 100, it rolls you into another thread, he said. There were spools and spools of threads, a Googleplex of messages, he joked. Their feelings for one another grew and took on a new shape. "We talked a lot about the minefield of managing to fall in love and actively grieve at the same time," she said. "There were also lighter, more flirtatious exchanges. They gossiped about the private Facebook group, Hot Young Widows Club, and shared poetry. He sent her Philip Larkin's When First We Faced and Touching Showed. Beyond the moonlight and the frost, the excitement and the gratitude, there stood how much our meeting owed to other meetings, other loves, the decades of a different life." In late April, Lucy, who is 38 and a clinical assistant professor of medicine at Stanford University, had a business trip to Raleigh, North Carolina, about an hour from John's home. "I knew I had to see her," he said. Lucy felt the same way. At the time, the two had never spoken. They had made an email-only rule. Seeing each other face-to-face was intense. "We held each other for a long time," she said. "There were two dinner dates and, by both accounts, a lot of chemistry." Lucy then returned to California. Their relationship was blossoming, but still mostly a secret. John's children, Freddie, 10, and Benny, 8, knew about it, as did Lucy's 3-year-old daughter, Katie. Nina's publisher had arranged a dual publicity tour in June for John and Lucy, given the common theme of When Breath Becomes Air and The Bright Hour. Lucy and John were both terrified and excited to be on stage together. At one engagement, a Facebook Live event in Sausalito, interviewer Kelly Corrigan jokingly asked when John and Lucy might get engaged. John turned purple, Lucy recalled. By the end of the summer, the couple had begun to speak openly about the relationship to their extended family and friends. There were sweet photos shared on Facebook. The families had been getting together regularly, though the arrangements are difficult, with 3 children, 2 jobs, and a continent between them. As the kids played in the yard in California last week, John and Lucy bantered about which house is more child-friendly, which has more bedrooms, which climate is better. We need to find a place in the middle and move there, Lucy said. They joked about writing a sequel to their late spouse's books, When Breath Becomes the Bright Hour. At Lucy's home, reminders of their late spouses remain. There are photographs of Paul in the kitchen and along the hallway. On the refrigerator is a Christmas card of the Duberstein family, including Nina. In an odd coincidence, Lucy owns the same couch Nina featured in her column. Both John and Lucy still wear their wedding rings. As the couple and their children celebrate the New Year's holiday together, there was a warmth and cohesiveness that made the group feel, as Katie said, like a whole family. John sliced apples for Katie. The three kids drew and played games together. In person and on the page, Nina and Paul had given their spouses radical permission, Lucy said, to enter new relationships, even to remarry. But following through on that brings up complicated emotions. I plan to spend my entire life with Nina. I was 100% happy doing that, John said. Nina's death forced him onto another course. Having a second relationship is a tragedy, he said, but he acknowledges with deep gratitude the series of fortunate events that have led him to Lucy, a woman his wife had tacitly approved. Lucy and John both recognize the lingering pain and the inevitable challenges they face. Entering into a relationship, Lucy noted, means accepting the possibility of losing your partner. If you are lucky enough, she said, you will be devastated when they die. Willingly entering that feels gutsy, but what else could you choose? For now, they are relishing their time together in all its complexity. On December 31st, Lucy, John, and the three kids headed out to visit Paul Kalanithi's grave, which overlooks the Pacific Ocean. They played Paul's favorite music and blew New Year's noisemakers. Together with members of Paul's extended family, they watched the last sunset of a sad, happy, and surprising year. This article originally appeared in the Washington Post. I'm going to read a few of the health and science pieces today. The first is cold snaps and climate change. The East Coast was gripped by record cold and powerful storms last week, with every state from Maine to Florida under a blanket of frigid air. Tallahassee saw its first snowfall since 1989, while in the Northeast, a bomb cyclone, a storm strengthened by an extreme drop in atmospheric pressure, produced 60-mile-per-hour blizzards and dumped up to 12 inches of snow. But meteorologists and climatologists have pushed back against the notion that recent freezing temperatures and snowy conditions refute or challenge the legitimacy of climate change, reports CNN. Counterintuitively, the icy blast may in fact be a product of a warming world. Research shows that warmer air and shrinking Arctic ice weaken the polar jet stream, the strong band of winds that forms where balmy breezes form the mid-latitudes and frigid Arctic air meet. This weakening allows frosty air that is normally trapped in the Arctic to descend into North America, the much-feared polar vortex. Atmospheric scientists warn that as the world warms and normal atmospheric patterns are disrupted, extreme weather events of all kinds will become more common. Indeed, it was warmer than usual last week in most of the world. In Alaska, it was 49 degrees, warmer than in Florida. To conclude that a temporary cold snap in one part of the globe disproves climate change, said a climate scientist, Peter Frumhoff, is like saying, if everyone around me is wealthy, then poverty is not a problem. Super Blue Blood Moon. The first month of 2018 will conclude with a super blue blood moon, a rare celestial event last seen in 1866. The phenomenon, due on January 31st, occurs when a supermoon, blue moon, and total lunar eclipse take place simultaneously. A supermoon is the lunar body at perigee, its closest approach to Earth. Normally an average of 238,855 miles from us. The moon will be roughly 16,000 miles closer on January 31st, making it appear up to 14% bigger and 30% brighter than usual. The supermoon will coincide with January's second full moon, or blue moon, and they will both take place at the same time as a total lunar eclipse, when the sun, Earth, and the moon are aligned, with the moon in Earth's shadow. During the total lunar eclipse, the sunlight refracted through Earth's atmosphere gives the lunar surface a reddish hue, an effect known as a blood moon. We're seeing all of Earth's sunrises and sunsets at the moment reflected from the surface of the moon, NASA program scientist Sarah Noble tells Forbes.com. The best views of the super blue moon will be from Central and Eastern Asia, Indonesia, New Zealand, and Australia. But stargazers in Alaska and Hawaii could also catch a glimpse. Diabetes drug for Alzheimer's. Scientists seeking a cure for diabetes may have stumbled across a treatment for Alzheimer's disease. A team at Lancaster University in England gave mice that had been genetically engineered to have the neurodegenerative condition a triple receptor diabetes drug that activates the growth factors GLP-1, GIP, and glucagon, hormones that help protect the brain from degeneration. Alzheimer's is associated with impaired growth factor signaling, which causes nerve cells to lose function. The researchers found that the mice demonstrated significantly improved memory and learning during a maze test, and also had reduced inflammation and plaque buildup in the brain. Successful rodent studies often fail to translate into human treatments, but the researchers nevertheless call their findings very positive development, reports BusinessInsider.com. With no new treatments in nearly 15 years, we need to find new ways of tackling Alzheimer's, said Doug Brown for the Alzheimer's Society. It's imperative that we explore whether drugs developed to treat other conditions can benefit people with Alzheimer's. And we're on the Talking Points page. We'll take this article that says, Oprah, growing talk of a 2020 run. Progressives rejoice, said Sally Kahn in CNN.com. With an inspiring, stump-ready speech at the Golden Globes on Sunday about ending sexual harassment, Oprah Winfrey ignited long-simmering speculation that she would run for president in 2020. Some of the billionaire TV star's friends said she was actively considering a presidential run, and her best friend, CBS This Morning co-host Gail King, said Oprah was intrigued by the idea. Democrats are intrigued, too. Winfrey is everything President Trump is not, a genuinely self-made billionaire who climbed to the pinnacle from poverty with a long history of helping and inspiring people. Winfrey is certainly popular enough to win, said Josh Barrow in BusinessInsider.com. Her millions of viewers and fans, many of them working-class women, believe that Oprah gets them and cares about them. She would appeal to many of the Americans who voted for Trump in a way other Democratic candidates could not. Get a grip, people, said Paul Waldman in TheWashingtonPost.com. Yes, Winfrey would probably win the Democratic nomination, with the media doing everything in its power to create a Trump-Oprah throwdown, but her record is far from stainless. She has given a prominent platform to anti-vaxxers and promoted quackery, including The Secret, a lucrative self-help program that teaches if you wish really hard for something, you will somehow get it. Besides, we've already elected a billionaire celebrity with no experience in politics, foreign policy, and governance, and it's proving an unmitigated disaster. What we'll need after Trump is a deeply serious figure with a strong record of public service, said Thomas Chatterton Williams in the New York Times. The fact that so many liberals would prefer Oprah is a damning sign that the party has no one better, and that the presidency has become just another prize for celebrities. It's not the voters' fault that celebrities are running for office, said Michael Brendan Doherty in NationalReview.com. I blame the wonks. Elected leaders have effectively ceded responsibility for governing to a permanent bureaucracy of hundreds of thousands of policymakers, party apparatchiks, and experts who actually run Washington. As a result, there is no need for wise, experienced elected leaders. In the New World Order, celebrities like Trump and Oprah can do the job of winning elections and riling up the public, while the permanent political class makes the real decisions. Voter fraud, why Trump's commission died. Ding dong, the White House's Election Integrity Commission is dead, said Miles Rappaport in the American Prospect. With a tweet, President Trump last week abruptly shut down the sham commission created to justify Trump's ludicrous claim that he lost the popular vote because 3 million to 5 million illegal immigrants voted for Hillary Clinton. The commission was ostensibly a fair-minded investigation into voter fraud, but was nothing more than a Trojan horse for a voter suppression agenda. Its co-chair, Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach, had spent his career trying and failing to prove that voter fraud is epidemic. He called for strict federal voter identification laws before the commission was even created. Luckily, both Republican and Democratic election officials saw through the charade, with 44 states refusing to comply with some or all of the commission's sweeping demands for information on voters, such as their Social Security numbers. The secretive commission was also buried in a blizzard of lawsuits, crippling its work out the gate. No voter should be happy about this, said Michael Thielen, executive director of the Republican National Lawyers Association, in TheHill.com. Liberals derailed the commission's work before it could even get started. Why were they so afraid of an inquiry into fraudulent voting by non-citizens? But while they've won this battle, liberals may lose the war. President Trump has charged the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, with taking over the commission's investigation, and it will have far more power to cross-check voter rolls against its own immigration records. Let's see what the agents find. This fight will now get uglier, said Charles Stewart III in the Washington Post. When DHS compares voter lists with data on undocumented immigrants, it's guaranteed to generate thousands of false positives from people sharing the same names and birth dates. A lot of people with names like Maria Rodriguez could end up being wrongly purged from voter rolls. There is already overwhelming evidence that voter fraud is vanishingly rare, said Jamel Bowie in Slate.com. But Republicans see voter suppression as critical to holding on to power. So they are aggressively pushing state laws to make it harder for poor people and minorities who lean Democratic to vote. Last year, lawmakers in 31 states introduced 99 bills to restrict access to voter registration. Trump's commission may be dead, but its spirit lives on. And let's see, a couple of short notes as we wind up the hour. Trump's official working day begins at 11 a.m., according to a leaked copy of his private schedule. His mornings are listed as executive time, which he generally spends in his bedroom watching TV, tweeting, and making phone calls. During the rest of his day, he generally has two or three meetings, a full hour for lunch, and more executive time. On some days, his official duties end by 4:15 p.m. As the northeastern U.S. was dealing with a bomb cyclone that caused wind chills as low as 100 degrees below zero in New Hampshire, regions of Australia were dealing with the most catastrophic heat wave in nearly 80 years. In a Sydney suburb, temperatures hit 117 degrees Fahrenheit, while a six-mile stretch of a highway in Victoria melted into soft, sticky asphalt. On the poll watch, 42% of Americans now identify as independents, up from 39% in 2016. 29% identify as Democrats, and 27% of Americans identify as Republicans. And we'll finish with a quote from George Bernard Shaw, who says, "People who say it cannot be done should not interrupt those who are doing it." With that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.